This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
From the rolling bluffs of the Driftless region to the pristine shorelines of Superior in Michigan, from the Northwoods to the Kettle Moraine, Civic Media broadcasts across all of Wisconsin. For all of Wisconsin. Take a trip with us across the radio network to hear from communities throughout the state. This is the Civic Media Spotlight.
Welcome into Hour 2 of the Civic Media Spotlight. Former President Jimmy Carter passed away last weekend, and Jim Santel, host of Amicus, a law review, had the honor of working with him way back in 1980 as an intern. John and Gordy, hosts of the John and Gordy Show in Madison, welcomed him on the show to talk about his experience.
This portion of the show is being brought to you by Ed's Legal Clinic. Remember Ed's motto, no matter how big your problem is, we'll take it. No matter how weak your case is, we'll take it. And no matter how large your bankroll is, we'll take it.
All right, 92.7 WMDX, the John and Gordy Show. And our special guest, Jim Santel, is with us with his legal opinions. But we're going to kind of put that on hold a moment because you had worked with Jimmy Carter at one time.
Yeah, tell us about that, Jim.
Yeah, I did. First of all, Happy New Year to you. Mm-hmm. Good to be with you once again. Of course, all your listeners as well. Yes, yeah, so this is how old I am. When I tell these stories recently, people look at me and say, how old are you, Jim? Right? And just I said, well, most of it was in the 20th century, a little bit in the 19th and 18th centuries. But yeah, quite seriously, again, this was right before after I graduated from college and before I went on to law school at the University of Chicago. And frankly, they were looking for some interns in the what would turn out to be the final term of Jimmy Carter's presidency. So this was the summer of 1980, had one of the most spectacularly important times in my life. Again, have some neat memorabilia, still have the old pass to get into the West Wing at the time. And I had this wonderful opportunity. Of course, Jimmy was not consulting with me on a daily basis, but and as an intern, actually, we had this office way on the top of the old executive office building, which is that big building adjacent to the White House. But I had this wonderful opportunity to work in the domestic policy staff. And so one of the things that I remember quite clearly is Jimmy Carter's great commitment to environmental issues. And at the time, you may recall, this is all about energy. Remember, gas prices were high. Mm-hmm. We were honestly thinking, and maybe we're still right about that, that we're going to run out of oil. Remember this?
Yes.
And the concern was, how do we conserve and how to preserve the future? And so some of the things that he said, again, at the time are really quite remarkable, not only in terms of being foreshadowing things that have come up, but also he put together the President's Energy Efficiency Awards in 1980, had an opportunity to be there for that, awarding people and institutions around the nation who have done things to preserve energy and think about the future of our environment. And then the Energy Security Act of 1980, all kinds of things. He led that and put that together and signed that again on a South Lawn event. Many other experiences there, but those kind of stand out not only because of the significance of them at the time. You may recall, too, he installed solar panels on the roof of the White House.
Yes.
People thought that was kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan takes them down, tellingly, right? But all those kinds of things, we look back, and yes, although it was, 45 years now, the reality is this is a man before his time. And I would push back, therefore, for many reasons that included on this notion that somehow he was not a successful president, but a successful post-presidency. I think we need to look at many things that he did during that term, which I can also provide you with a list of that are significant. Yeah.
Well, you were holding up before we went on the air a photo album that you had of pictures of you posing with, is it Carter, or is it just your
exactly.
time?
There's one ray in the back here where we are. Here we are together in the. This is in the Roosevelt Room, right across from the from the White House, from the Oval Office, and I'm standing kind of off to one side here. And this is remember Hamilton Jordan,
yes,
and
sure.
People, others like that. This is Lloyd Cutler, his his attorney. Here's Jimmy Carter. That was the group of kind of interns, but also some staff people in 1980. And again, at those opportunities, we had a chance to talk with him quite literally around the table. And, you know, at that time, we didn't know that he was going to be defeated by Ronald Reagan in just a few months from there. I was a very low-level intern, basically doing copying and doing a lot of gopher work, so to speak. But this is a man, once again, who brokered the Camp David Accords, Israel and Egypt opening up that opportunity.
Yes.
Obviously, Middle East peace remains an aspiration for us. Diplomatic relations with China, ratification of the Panama Canal treaties, again, back in the news a lot today as the incoming president talks about how stupid it was, as he has said, for Jimmy Carter to sell the Panama Canal for a dollar. Moved beyond the Vietnam era. He pardoned all the Vietnam draft dodgers, second day in office, right?
Yeah.
Post-Watergate reforms. The Departments of Energy and Education, those were his creation, right? Fossil fuels, climate. And the Federal Reserve Chairman, appointed Paul Volcker, began to address kind of the notion of using economic policy to impact the economy and inflation, all kinds of things that we sometimes forget when we simply dismiss his presidency as being less significant than his post-presidency.
And Jim, you know, you kind of alluded to it before, but after his presidency, he accomplished so much as a former president, not only getting involved with Habitat for Humanity, but traveling the world and going to something like 150 countries and observing elections. And talk a little bit about some of his post-presidency activities.
Sure. Absolutely. They're huge. And again, sometimes they were somewhat controversial just because, of course, you've got a former president out there who really does. He's a private citizen right now, right? Doesn't really have any authority to do a whole lot. But you're right. I mean, following up on the Camp David Accords, Israel and Egypt were big portions of his post-presidency, ensuring that people understood each other there. Huge amount in Africa and East Asia. We forget about that as well. He's going around and he's not only monitoring elections, doing all sorts of things there to promote peace. Frankly, we know well that his brokering the release of people who are in custody in various nations around the world also. Something that probably we would normally think of just with the State Department or sitting president, he had the cachet. He had the capacity to do that. And so quite literally was a sort of a secondary foreign policy president, even in his post-presidency, and had impacts upon the world in a way that we have sort of dismissed too when we see him again building homes in Plains, Georgia and other places. Yeah. Tremendous work.
That's right.
Teaching Sunday school, right? This was truly a man who was committed to his faith and to his religion. And most importantly, not just religion for superficial purposes, but talked about the reasons why one pursues that in one's life, and that is to help people. And that was really his commission as he spoke, both from the pulpit and for his Sunday school classes. You compare that once again to the incoming president who is selling Bibles for $60 and signing them, right?
Right.
Completely different. And there's some wonderful pieces out there that I commend to your listeners about the differences even in that area. The person who brings to something like his own faith doesn't wear it on his sleeve, but makes it a part of his world and his actions. That too is the way we remember Jimmy Carter to this day. And again, it is the legacy that I think this gives us an opportunity. Obviously on the 9th coming up in seven short days, a week from today, he'll be lying in state and we'll hear a whole lot more about who he was. We've got former presidents, including some who wrote eulogies before they died. Gerald Ford wrote a eulogy. Others, you're going to hear all those. And there are other presidents talking about his significance as a president. That's very meaningful.
He wrote a lot of books, too, right?
He did.
Like 25 books?
Right. I think the number may actually be in the high 20s, if not the low 30s or so.
Wow.
And again, on everything from perspectives that in many ways, as you read them, they reflect not only on what he was perceiving, advocating again in the international arena, the domestic arena, but also they told you an awful lot about who this guy was. And again, I spoke about his home, for example, Plains, Georgia. there is that photograph of the Bidens visiting him. You may recall it was a little bit of a weird wide lens picture. So it looked kind of odd, got a lot of attention. But the big thing about that and the big thing Bidens took away from that is you go to their home and it looks like a home that was, with due respect and with admiration, kind of frozen in the 1970s. Mm. You can tell this is a man who's not investing in newfangled things. He had the, in the back porch, he had the cooler so that when the beverages could not be fit into the refrigerator, he had those out there. He died in the home that he lived in with Rosalind, and it's still there. And again, that too was not interested. Even the Carter Center, that's his legacy, but it's not a monument to him as some of these other libraries are. It's a monument to peace, and that's what the commission is. His executive director there talking about the continuing legacy of what Jimmy Carter did at that time will continue to do in the future as the Carter Center work continues. That, too, is a big part of his legacy. There are people there trained in doing diplomacy and trained in doing the kinds of things that he began on the world stage.
Did you have any contact with him after he left the presidency, Jim, or no?
I did not. So I wish desperately that I had. I went on to law school, and of course, at the time, this was, again, the post-presidency. This was when America, candidly, if I could be a little political on the time when we're thinking about this wonderful human being, the Ronald Reagan presidency, again, of 40 years ago, got us down the road where we are today. And I think you could look back, and only in terms of taxes and foreign policy, but even this notion of what the presidency can and should do. Jimmy Carter was the last of a kind who thought about, again, the personal thing that you bring to it, the messages that you convey. You remember he had that, again, very controversial discussion with America when he talked about his vision for America, but also talked about some of the malaise in America, right? Mm-hmm. And that may have been one of the reasons why he was defeated. Ronald Reagan comes in and speaks about the shining city on the hill and how we're great and America is great, with references now to what we're hearing again. And anyway, in the 4 years or so that followed that, there was a general sense of, okay, now we have to correct the Carter presidency. And I remember being in law school and thinking, gosh, I had this wonderful experience. I did not have direct contact with him, but I remember very much thinking that was not my feeling at the time. And even then, back in the 1980s, two terms of Ronald Reagan, followed by a decent term for George H.W. Bush, all of that period of time marked a very different time in America. We went in a very different direction and are still on that other path that Jimmy Carter warned against and probably would not recognize today.
Well, Jim, I have a few more questions, and these are more current questions, about Justice Roberts getting a little angry at what's going on in this country, ripping into judges. Let's get into that.
Can you stick around a couple more minutes?
So can you
absolutely.
Hold
on? Delighted to be with you.
All right. Fantastic.
On the second day of the new year.
There we go.
Let's do it.
Back with more with Jim Santel in just a moment.
The John and Gordy Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on WMDX weekday mornings from 6 until 8. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Next up on the Civic Media Spotlight, we'll hear from the Earl Ingram Show. Earl was joined by Alan Borsick, Senior Fellow in Public Policy at the Marquette Law School, to discuss issues facing the Milwaukee Public Schools. They dive into the politics of how the state funds education and how mismanagement has led to the current problems the district faces.
All right, welcome back to a Motown Monday on the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 855-752-4842. That's 855-752-4842. I'm always honored for my next guest to have on Mr. Alan Borsick. He is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University. He's an award-winning journalist that focuses a lot on education policy. Good morning to you, my friend. How are you?
I am good. How are you?
And happy Hanukkah to you.
Oh, thank you. Everybody's having a good holiday season and start of a good, sweet year ahead, a healthy year ahead for everybody, I hope.
Yes, sir. So I have to, every time I read your articles, about Milwaukee Public Schools, which you've been writing for a long, long time. I'm a product of Milwaukee Public Schools. I had 11 sisters and brothers who graduated from Milwaukee Public Schools. My mom retired from Milwaukee Public Schools. I volunteered 12 years in Milwaukee Public Schools, countless nieces and nephews, and my children went to Milwaukee Public Schools. So I am, it's safe to say I'm invested in Milwaukee Public Schools. And I live in the city of Milwaukee, and I've lived there my entire life, Alan, and I'm going to die there. So I am interested in everything that happens in Milwaukee Public Schools. And it's unfortunate because I've been a total supporter of the district all of my life. But Alan, I've never seen it in the condition it's in now, and you wrote another great article about where it stands now, and you've written many articles. But right now, with all the different articles and all you know about the district, where would you say that Milwaukee Public Schools, the largest school district in the entire state, stands?
Well, I think on the on the good news side, there are still students such, you know, your nieces and nephews and your own family's experience. There's still people who are getting a good education and going to good schools and having good teachers. The problem, of course, is that there's just not enough of them. Overall, the district, I agree with you, is in a very difficult situation, could well be the most difficult of all the time that I've been following, which, depending on what you use as a starting point, you could even count up to 50 years. I'm so old, like you said, senior
we,
fellow.
We. We.
But yes, they have so many problems and so many challenges, and so many bad things happened in the course of 2024. Not only the financial mess, which got so much attention, but there's actually a list of things, even to not succeeding in getting a couple of football teams into the state tournament. I mean, how bad is that?
Yeah.
I really felt for all these athletes at those schools who through no fault of their own. Right. But in any case, they have problems on problems. They've got problems with the legislature. They've got problems with the community and the community leadership. But most of all, they got problems just running an education system and seeing enough success.
You know, Alan,
not enough success.
It is an issue for the entire state of Wisconsin. It can't possibly be isolated solely to the city of Milwaukee. Milwaukee is the biggest city in the state, but it's also has the largest school district, and all of these children who become adults, Alan, and so it's an issue that is bigger than just the city. Is it safe to say that?
Oh, I totally agree. I think there are a lot of people who would not agree. They'd say, I got mine. My kids are going to good schools. My kids don't live in the city of Milwaukee, don't face the issues that you have in the urban setting. You know, I'm rich, I'm in the suburbs, I'm in other parts of the state. And hooray for kids who are getting a good education. But yes, if MPS is not doing well, that's something that affects the entire state. It affects the economy, affects the future. I mean, the biggest cliche in education is that kids are the future. Well, it's true. One of the things that's not really MPS's fault is that they end up with a disproportionate number of
special ed
kids,
right,
and kids with major discipline problems. That said, if you look at the big picture, one of the things MPS hasn't done for 30 years now is make their schools overall an appealing choice to people. It is a choice world when it comes to schools, and MPS has to figure out more how to get more people to choose MPS. There are certain schools where that happens, mostly specialty schools and schools with what they call selective admission. Reagan High School on the South Side is a prime example at the moment. But, you know, people aren't choosing to go to MPS in enough numbers to keep the district strong.
So if you're just joining us, I'm joined by Alan Borsick. He is a Marquette University Law fellow, and he, you know, renowned award-winning journalist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he just wrote an article that I was reading the other day, and it was, "Who Will Step Up to Lead MPS? Superintendent Search Reopens and Most School Board Members Up for Election Don't Plan to Run Again." You know, Alan, you and I talked a little bit about this the other day. If you want to be a school board member, they pay $20,000, a budget that's $1.4 billion, equivalent to Milwaukee County, dealing with just horrific types of circumstances with so many young people failing. And the social issues that impact and affect the students that go to Milwaukee Public Schools. I don't think people really know, as I said before, I spent 12 years volunteering there. The social issues, that impact the students before they even come to school, Alan, is a big issue. The district has become a social service agency before it can even begin to educate. And yet it is measured as a school that is not doing what it can to educate students. And people dismiss the total fact that they have to feed children before they even do anything else. They have to clothe children before they do anything else. Kids come to school without socks. Kids come to school without coats. They come to school without hats and gloves. They come to school hungry. In many of the schools, the kids are there from 6, 7 a.m. in the morning until 7 p.m. It's the only place they can feel safe and get a meal, Alan. And yet none of those things are taken into consideration when people judge Milwaukee Public Schools. Hold the thought. 855-752-4842. My guest is the one and only Alan Borsick. And Alan Borsick is a senior fellow in law and public policy and award-winning journalist for the Milwaukee Milwaukee Journal. 855-752-4842 is the number. It's a Motown Monday on the Earl Ingram Show.
The Earl Ingram Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on select Civic Media stations weekday mornings from 8 till 10. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
Welcome back to the Civic Media Spotlight. If you didn't get enough of Earl Ingram just a few minutes ago, fear not. He's on with Dom Salvia this week, and in the next segment of the Dom Salvia Show, the pair discussed the need for elder leaders to pass the torch. With the average age of a U.S. senator being 68 years, it's no wonder that young people didn't turn up to vote.
Hey, welcome back to the Dom Salvia Show, 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. Earl Ingram joining me for this next half hour. Appreciate you, Earl. Just PS on the board as well. You can join us, 855-75-CIVIC. Talking about the endorsement, Senator Chuck Schumer endorsing Wisconsin's own Ben Wickler to head the DNC. We'd love to see that. Talking about kind of brings us to the conversation of age, which is something Earl knows a lot about. Ben Wickler is 43 years old. He's got a birthday coming up next month.
Wow.
Yeah, right? So young cat.
I didn't know he was that young.
He certainly carries himself older than that. Uncle Tony chimes in real quick, Earl, if I may. David Hogg running for vice chair. Now, David Hogg was a survivor of one of the mass school shootings. He's 24 years old and said, "I raise all this money to get young voters for you. I want a seat at the table." Yeah, man. I mean, it makes sense. So I'd love to see these younger folks coming in, getting involved, and not only getting involved. I mean, a lot of young people are involved early. You know how it is. We go out and go out to some of these political events. Even in the press, a lot of young folks in the press, now, you know, those aren't the folks that get, you know, a lot of the FaceTime on the telly, right? But there's a lot of folks out there running around, the young reporters asking those questions, and we're wondering why they're asking them. They're long nights. You're on your feet a lot. You know, there's a lot of running around. It is a young person's game to a large extent. Similarly, with the politicians, a lot of staff are younger, but a lot of those folks, Schumer, Pelosi, been there a long, long time. I'm sorry. Finish your thought. You earlier were talking about.
So the average congressperson in the 118th Congress is 58 years of age. The Congress that's coming in, 58. The average senators is 68.
Just
think about that, man. 68 is the average age of a United States senator. And if you know, some of them just can't do it anymore. And that probably has dropped because there's some senators in their 80s and 90s who just couldn't do it anymore in the last 4 or 5 years, Dominic.
Come on, man. There's a Republican congresswoman who was like found in a memory care unit. She hasn't voted in like 6 months. And I'm not knocking. I mean, I get it. You know, I understand. But come on, where's the representation? Where's the work? And, you know, I'm a Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I'm a fan. But what? She was like 87 when she died at the Supreme Court. I mean, she could have. Stepped down earlier and had Obama replace her. Instead, we got Amy Coney Barrett. These things, and I don't know, maybe it's just the attraction to the power. You know, you get used to a lifestyle, and maybe you get a little tunnel vision the older you get, man. But I don't want to die behind the desk, man. You know what I mean? I want to do the best I can for a little while longer, and maybe bring some folks up and help them out. You know what I'm saying? Because it's a younger person. Say, I'll be here if you need me on a consulting basis. You go do that. Knock yourself out. I'm down for that. Don't want to be the one to die at the desk, man. I'd love to see some of these folks getting out of Dodge a little earlier. I talked about Jerry Connolly from the New Republic. A little bit from here, and then we'll get to your calls, 855-752-4842. 74-year-old Democrat who ran against AOC offers an infuriating defense, according to the New Republic. Representative Jerry Connolly beat AOC in the race for top leadership in the party, then defended the move the most outrageous way possible. Well, how was that? Well, here's a little bit of the story. Now, he did beat her to become the ranking member of the Oversight Committee, the House Oversight Committee. It was a battle of establishment Democratic politics versus new wave progressivism, and the Democratic caucus opted to vote against the future of the party by a margin of 47 votes. So that wasn't close. Now, when pressed on why a 74-year-old with a recent esophagus cancer diagnosis deserved a shot at arguably one of the most influential positions in the House, Connolly couldn't muster up a response deeper than having paid his dues. Speaking with CNN on Monday, Connolly's rationale boiled down to simple entitlement. Here's his quote. The decision about leadership ought to always be based on a proven record, skill set, competence, capability, and your plan for moving forward, Connolly told CNN. I've never had my chance to be a ranking member or a chairman of a full committee. This is it. I've got the bona fides and the credentials over 16 years that my colleagues looked at, examined, validated, and decided. That's what we need. And that's what the Democratic caucus overwhelmingly decided to do. As the New Republic points out, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was reportedly entrenched in the process of getting Connolly to lead the key investigative body for the purpose of keeping AOC away from the fulcrum of power. So even within these political parties that, you know, we generally support, they got their own infighting and politics and whatever going on. And I don't know that, you know, having a 74-year-old beating out AOC by 47 votes, certainly that apparently that's what they want. But come on, man, you're gonna, who you get, is this guy turning out anybody under 30?
Well, that's why I call it politics. That's the reason I call it politics, man. It's you know, younger people, many of them did not vote. And maybe they didn't vote because they look and see a bunch of fossils who continue to talk about things that don't matter to people who have the whole future ahead of them.
No, no.
And so maybe if AOC was there, people who didn't vote would have come out and voted. This is the part of it that I don't understand, Dominic. Almost half of the American people don't vote. And yet the Democrats say, well, we've got to be more like the Republicans. We've got to change the way we've been doing things because we know we lost. And my response is, no, you don't have to be like the Republicans, man. No. Go after the people who don't vote.
Right.
Do something, say something to address those people, and it'll be a landslide. You don't have to follow the Republicans and be like, man, what is this, man?
No, yeah. There's a lot of room to change without moving in that particular direction. Yes.
Yeah, and the Republican strategy is what? To make it so obscene that no one wants to get involved, mm-hmm. and so you win by diminishing, you know, the
right.
electorate.
Just destabilize, insert right. chaos.
That's what I'm saying. There's such an opportunity, to your point, Earl, and to you, Jess, as well. There's such an opportunity for those folks that don't vote. You're going to tell me you can't come up with some messaging. Hell, messaging, you know, you can have several people can say the same words. You know, who says it? Who resonates when they say it? You know what I'm saying, Earl? I mean, if you're going to talk right. about something, you know, Social Security, and you're an older cat, man, you've been involved, and I'm gonna believe and trust what you have to say on those issues. If we're going to talk about, you know, what some of the younger folks are dealing with right now in the reality, you know, maybe it's more like Jess who would I want to have that conversation with, who's more dialed into, you know, that topic and that age group. I mean, those things are there. Not to say that older folks can't represent younger folks and vice versa. But come on, we can do something different. You know what I mean? And hey, I like, hey, yeah,
Earth,
go ahead.
Earth to Dominic, I used to be young. Okay. All of us, one solid thing about this thing called life is if you live long enough, you're going to age.
If you're lucky.
I don't care where you are.
Uh-huh.
You're going to get there if you're lucky enough to live long enough. But the point I'm making is at a given point in time, we have to understand it's not our world anymore. Yep. The baby boomers is not our world, man. We were around during the Cold War, Dominic.
It's not only not your world, Earl. It might be your fault. I'm just saying.
I know. Hey, man, I know. All right. Come on, man. Come on. Time to step aside.
Yeah. Oh, now, it doesn't have to be a step aside, man. You know, I mean, you know, help people out, man. You still be a part, man. You know how it is to mentor and to bring folks in and to be a rock and a source.
That's what
for
I
folks.
Do.
That's what you do, man. I mean, you do it on the radio. You do it in your personal life, man. I mean, that's it's not like you got to step. You're out of it. You know, you can still have influence. You don't need to be the point person in front of the camera. You have to let the young, good-looking folks do that, man. You know, but you know, there's a lot of legacy wisdom that can be there. But I think to the extent that those folks, for presumably personal ego reasons, want to stay there, want to stay in that power. You know, when someone steps down, what do we talk about Joe Biden when he finally, you know, came around and decided not to run? Well, we thought, man, what a selfless.
They forced him out.
What a selfless act. Well, he didn't have to. Yeah. Oh, come on, man. I don't buy that. Grown-ass man, Joe Biden, president, did not have to do that. He saw the writing on the wall.
Finally, but it took a really long time.
Well, he never should have ran in the first place.
He never should have run in the first place. Right.
Hey, but it wasn't so much that he was running for himself. It was all of those people around him whose jobs and careers
right.
are connected to him, and they wanted him to stay there because it meant more gravy train for them.
Anymore. Absolutely. Great point. A little bit here from ABC News. I think it was Uncle Tony who brought it up. David Hogg, gun control activist, March for Our Lives co-founder, and Parkland school shooting survivor, running for vice chair of the DNC. Here's a quote from him. I think this role is a great way for one, bringing newer voices into the Democratic Party. I just want to be one of the several of those voices to help represent young people. And also, more than anything, make sure that we're standing up to the consulting class that increasingly the Democratic Party is representing instead of the working class. I mean, that's some wise words from the young 24-year-old David Hogg. But you're going to make some people mad if you start talking like that. Because as you mentioned, Earl, the gravy train is there. What else does he say here? We need to realize that we are increasingly the party of sycophants. We are just surrounding ourselves with people who tell us what we want to hear instead of what we need to hear. We're increasingly surrounding ourselves with paid political consultants that are letting what donors say to them guide their talking points. Oh, man. Yes, please. Can I have some more of that? And what really bothers me, we say to people all the time, who's to blame for this election? It's young people. It's ex-minority group. But really, who's to blame for this? It's us. It's us. Ultimately, we failed to communicate. We failed to have a broader strategy within the party to make sure that we're telling the president what he needed to hear rather than what he wanted to hear, which was that he needed to drop out. David Hogg running for vice chair of the DNC. Liken that. I mean, that is some wisdom, but you're also ruffling a lot of feathers, Earl, because when you talk about, you know, shaking up the system like that, you know who doesn't want that? The same folks who told Joe, you're fine, stay in, the ones that are getting paid.
Right, man, come on.
And those that are getting paid do not give that up lightly. Not at all. It's not our world anymore. We've been trying to tell you guys that, man, says Cam. We keep talking about cognitive tests for leadership, but I want a better one. And my test will task each congressman and senator with converting a Word document to a PDF. If they can't do that, they're publicly stoned. I don't know. Stoning seems a little harsh, Cam, but I appreciate it. You know that. But that's
death
why
by a thousand paper cuts.
That's why their staff. You know, I used to know how to cut the audio up pretty good, but now Jess does it. You know, yeah. I could do it if I had to.
You had to.
If I really,
but
really
passed that torch.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And I'm here for, you know, advice and consultation. You know, with a day's notice or so. I'm happy to contribute to the younger generation. Yeah, man, Earl, this is what we need to do. We need the younger folks. We need folks like Ben Wickler. We need folks like David Hogg to come in. And it's not just the fact that they're young, right? They're young, they're articulate, they're smart,
they're smart.
Successful. They've got a track record. Even at 24, man, this dude's been around. I mean, if you're hounded by Marjorie Taylor Greene when you're like 19 years old, walk around the Capitol, I think that gives you a little bit of cred. You know what I'm saying? Folks, this is the Dom Salvia Show.
What's up, Dominic?
Yeah, go ahead.
My generation had to push through the same thing the older generation.
It's a constant generational battle. Come back with us, 855-75-CIVIC.
The Dom Salvia Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekdays from 4 till 6. To learn more about this show and all the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Closing out the Civic Media Spotlight for this week, we'll hear from Mino and the mayor out of Green Bay. And speaking of Green Bay, we're talking the Packers. They welcome on Tony Walters, who was a reporter in 1967 at the famed Ice Bowl.
Coming to Northeast Wisconsin live from the Civic Media Studios and featuring TV and radio broadcast veteran John Mino, along with the City of Green Bay's longest-serving mayor, Jim Schmidt. This is Mino and the Mayor. Here are your hosts, John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
Hey, thank you very much. Welcome back. Mino the Mayor here on New Year's Eve 2024. Got a couple of other texts coming in. It would be great movies to watch tonight. The Great Santini. Robert Duvall was so good in that movie. It's unbelievable. Plays the part of a fighter pilot who's really mean to his son, but mean in a way that he wants his son to be tough growing up. Great, great, great movie. Let's go to our man, Tony Walters. Tony, good morning, my friend.
Good morning, gentlemen.
How are you?
I'm waking up.
I was just going to say your voice never changes. You,
it's always raspy.
You're always waking up, huh?
Hey, Tony.
Happy New Year to you, Tony. We were just talking about New Year's Eve, very special day. But and we've had you on before talking about your book. But
and I just want to back up real quick. Oh. Just give another Tony Walters. How many years with the Press Gazette, Tony?
Just about 40 years.
40 years. Press Gazette. Mm-hmm. Grew up in Green Bay. Long, unbelievable family heritage in Green Bay over the years. And did so much for the city of Green Bay. Now an author. Wrote a great book on the Ice Bowl. But anyway, I'm just going to take it from there. Jim.
Oh, sorry. I just, he's one of those guys I think everybody knows.
And they do, but I just want to.
Yeah. Okay, so we, all right, now.
That was Broadcasting 101, wasn't it, Todd?
I was, absolutely.
See, and I didn't take that course, Tony, as you know. But tell us, the Ice Bowl, right? I mean, people are talking about it today. And I think that's awesome about Green Bay. It's the part of who we are.
Has anything ever happened in Green Bay that is more memorable worldwide than the Ice Bowl, Tony?
Probably not. I mean, it just is, reminds, you know, it's impacted so many people in a lot of different ways, even those that weren't there. So, it's people still talk about it. As Chuck Mersine told me, that it's a game that'll never die.
Yep. That's exciting. So with that, tell me your fondest memory of that, because everybody has theirs. Kind of not a Kennedy thing, but, you know, kind of people who were around really remember where they were. Like, my father-in-law was at the game. And is that really true that if everybody said they were at the game, we're at the game?
A million people.
Yeah. But he really was there. He was there. How about you, Tony?
I was on the field. I was supposed to work with a photographer from the Associated Press, where I would run his film to a dark room under the stadium, but his camera froze before the game started, and he left. And I had nothing to do but just walk the sidelines. And when Bart scored the winning touchdown, I was right there at the goal line. So it was very memorable that way.
Wow.
But,
I'm not sure. Yeah. I guess John knew that.
That's no, I didn't know you were at the goal line watching that. I just assumed you were working. I remember the part about the photographer. I didn't know. How old were you, Tony, if you don't mind my asking? You had to be really young.
I was 22.
Okay.
I was 22 at that time. I was just a part-timer in the sports department, and so they assigned me there.
Tony, what are some of the things in regards to, like, with your book? And first of all, where can everybody get it?
Just about Bosses and DePere.
Yep.
Has it. Barnes & Noble also has it. And other bookstores through the valley, too, have it as well. Plus, you can get it on Amazon. So,
Tell the name of it, Tony.
Ice Bowl, the game that will never die.
There you go. Tony, in talking with the people, and obviously you at the front, when you talk about somebody having a front row seat, I can't imagine somebody having more of a front row seat than being on the goal line as the air goes in. But in talking to people, what are some of the things that maybe they told you where it's like, oh my gosh, I never knew that? Were there anything, or did you pretty much know going in everything that happened that day?
Well, yeah, and I wasn't looking for people to tell me it was cold or to tell me that the Packers won.
Right.
You know, it was how the game impacted. And the kind of the moving stories, the high school girl who surprised her father with tickets to the game, his first game ever. And then the people that still have pieces of the goalpost, that they have kept. And you mentioned Vietnam with the one man, my friend Tyler, who was guarding a bridge with another soldier in the middle of the night, and listening to the game on
Armed Forces Radio.
Armed Forces Radio. And then his friend, who was from Dallas, later was killed in Vietnam. And Tyler went to Washington to find his friend's name on the memorial. So the impact of the Ice Bowl has completely different significance to him. So it was the way the game, you know, impacted people and their memories, whether they were at the game or not.
Did you go out that night, Tony, after work downtown?
No, I went home.
Okay.
I had nothing to do. My brother had his car, and we met at his car. It started, and we went home, and I'm sure there was probably some warm drinks waiting for us. I didn't linger.
Somebody just texted, did somebody take Tom Landry's hat that day? I know somebody grabbed Lombardi's, and he got it back from him. Right, Tony?
Yeah, he did. He grabbed it right back. And, yeah, that was amazing. The stuff that was carried out of there. Somebody carried a bench out of there.
Yep.
And the man that went down and sat on the Cowboys bench and took Don Meredith a warm-up jacket.
Yep.
And, security was certainly lax on that day.
Well, I didn't realize, so I read this not long ago, that after Stars scored, like a couple hundred fans rushed the field already.
to sell, and correct. The cops had to clear the field. You must have been in the middle of that, kind of, huh?
No, I stayed out of that. But
it wasn't far from you, yeah.
Because there were still two desperation passes that Meredith tried after that. The game wasn't over when Bart scored. So
you know what? I got to tell you something about that. Those last two plays, they're just, you know, whatever. I read Lance Renzel's book, When All the Laughter Died in Sorrow. Yeah. Did you ever read that book?
No, I did not.
Okay, Lance Renzel, bizarre story. Lance Renzel was a great receiver for the Dallas Cowboys. He was married to literally the hottest woman in the United States at the time, Joey Heatherton. Remember Joey Heatherton?
I do remember that. Yes.
Okay. Gorgeous. Yeah. I mean, she was almost like the Taylor Swift of the, you know what I mean? But she was just gorgeous and huge and popular. And he was married to her. And he had a mental illness where he was exposing himself to people. Yada, yada, yada. Okay.
Wow. Okay. Where's
the story? That's what he wrote the story about. He said, hey, this is my life. I'm going to lay it out there. I had this issue, yada, yada. I went to, but it was covered. Forget about that part. Okay. But
so he wrote a book about it. Does that have something to do with the ice bowl?
Can I finish?
Yeah.
He talked about in those last two plays where it's like he took off. It's Meredith was like, just run it. And he said he thought he was running. It's like, okay, he must have got sacked or something. And he realized the ball was coming to him and he'd already let up. And he said if he had run full speed,
really?
He had the DB beat, they could have won it on the last play of the game. A little something that, yeah. Isn't that something? He admits he blames himself for letting up and not running full speed.
What? And you think about your book, Tony, how that would have just changed
everything. You wouldn't be here, Tony. We wouldn't be talking to you.
Yeah, we
would. Stick with us. Tony Walters, back up this.
Mino and the Mayor is part of the Civic Media Radio Network. It airs on WISS and WGBW weekday mornings from 6 until 9. To learn more about this show and all of Civic Media's programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.